also led him to another profound idea that would come to be known as the law of inertia. Galileo realized that a ball, after rolling down one inclined plane, would roll up another until it regained its original height, no matter what the steepness of the second plane was. If the incline of the second plane was shallower, the ball would roll farther along, not stopping until it was as far above the horizontal as it had been at the start. The more nearly the second plane was horizontal, the farther the ball would roll, trying to regain its original height. Therefore, on a perfectly horizontal plane with a smooth surface, a ball would never come to rest. It would keep rolling forever. This was the crucial realization that Galileo needed to explain why everything, including his critics, could keep up with the spinning surface of the Earth. A body in horizontal motion tends to keep moving that way forever. But everything on the surface of the Earth is in horizontal motion at exactly the same speed as the surface of the Earth itself. There's not even any friction to affect the body's motion, because everything moves together. With this remarkable concept, Galileo overturned the ancient Aristotelian dogma that it's natural for all bodies to come to rest. Although Galileo's concept was brilliant, it wasn't entirely accurate. Still influenced by the Platonic ideal of circular motion, Galileo thought that a body in motion would continue forever, but only in the horizontal direction, not in a straight line, but round and round, following the surface of the Earth. A generation later, René Descartes straightened everything out, giving the law of inertia its final shape. Objects in motion don't tend by themselves to come to rest. They tend to continue as they are until something interferes. That fact's easier to see now than it was in Galileo's day. Today, few would disagree that the planet Earth curves around the sun. A sun that moves around one corner of a galaxy. A galaxy that moves alone in a cluster of galaxies. All streaking through the unimaginable vastness of the universe. How does the idea of rest fit into this grand scheme of things? It doesn't. Nothing in the universe comes to rest. Instead, anything and everything will continue to move as it is, in a straight line at a constant speed, until something interferes with it. That's the principle of inertia. And it's both as simple and as profound as any idea that's ever been pondered. Obviously, objects can seem to be at rest, but that's only because they're in the same state of motion as the viewer. Whether an object is at rest or in motion depends completely on viewpoint, on whether the observer is moving right along at the same speed. Absolute rest does not exist. Absolute motion does not exist. Even hurtling through space at an incredible speed, relative to the moon or the sun or the center of the galaxy, the natural tendency of any object is to retain whatever motion it has. In Galileo's day, that was a very difficult concept to accept. To an Aristotelian, the motion of a cart required and had a logical explanation. Unless something came along to push or pull it, it wouldn't move. Therefore, its natural state was that of rest. But to the modern observer, a vehicle in motion needs no explanation. This coasting object will keep moving until the brakes, or something else, brings it to a state of rest. But what about an object that's not just moving horizontally along with the surface of the Earth? What about a projectile launched into the air? Or a ball dropped from a tower?
This is the Aristotelian.
Shouldn't the spinning Earth leave the falling ball behind?
It'd be pretty far away. tower.
He said, the ball should continue to move horizontally with the earth, even as it falls vertically toward its surface. In the Renaissance, this concept was as hard to grasp as Quicksilver. So Galileo offered his contemporaries an analogy. He asked people to picture a ball falling from the mast of a moving ship. To a sailor on the deck, the mast is standing still. He would be surprised to see the ball fall straight down onto the deck at the foot of the mast. But anyone on shore would see the ship, and of course the mast, in motion. An Aristotelian observer would have no doubt at all about what should happen. The ball should fall directly toward the center of the earth while the ship sails out from under it. That sailor on deck would see the ball hurtle toward the rear of the ship rather than fall to the foot of the mast. Though the experiment was probably never performed during Galileo's life, the results are precisely what he predicted. The ball falls straight down.
Here we are, moving ship. Look at the ball.
The ball falls along the mast because both objects, ball and
sail, this time, don't watch
share
the mast,
same
just
initial motion.
Watch the distant point.
If they don't share the
same motion, then the
result is just as the Aristotelians would have expected.
The ship would follow backwards.
But when dropped from the moving mast,
watch.
The ball
falls moving
horizontally with the boat.
Yeah.
Together, these motions form a curved path, a parabola. Galileo realized that these same principles would cause the motion of any projectile to follow a parabolic curve, whether at sea or on land.
All right, so that's a little review, but you got to see the actual experiment, and we believe it works. Okay? Good. Okay. Another one for Newton, a little later. Okay. So, well, if that wasn't enough discovery for one person to do his lifetime, Galileo did more. Different arena. That's going to be the arena of astronomy. So we'd like to go into that now and then kind of put things together, maybe philosophically, of what he'd done. So we mentioned earlier that Sidereus Nuncius, a starry messenger, was printed here on the cover, actually. Looks like it's Latin, but he had published this in Italian. And in it, you find drawings that he made, such as the moon here, your telescope, close up. And most importantly, more pictures of the moon looked like close up. And first of all, when he looked at the moon, he saw lighter areas and dark areas. We can actually see that with our naked eye. What are they?
Craters.
But why are some regions darker? Craters. But he thought at this time, what were they? What would be darker? Seas. So they're called maria, seas. And so we have the idea that, well, the moon isn't this pristine object made of the fifth element. It's more like Earth with mountains and also seas on it. And then in addition, was to look at Jupiter. So there's a lot of drawings like this that have Jupiter and little asterisks. And those were four moons that he started to observe, and he watched them over time, and they went around with Jupiter. So not everything was going around the Earth. So we couldn't be the center of the entire universe if other objects were moving around another object, namely moons moving around Jupiter. So this was really a crushing blow to the idea that we are at the center of the universe. So his Jovian observations will be crucial there as well. Now, to do all of this, he didn't invent. He used the idea of a Dutch lens maker named Hans Lifferi to develop a telescope. So you're going to make a telescope here. I've got two sets, so basically we're going to do what he did. And in fact, if you went to the Museum of the History of Science, there they have his original lens from his telescope. And it's about this big, maybe a little bit smaller, and it's almost in a monstrance. It's highlighted, point this out, it's cracked. But that was his original eyepiece, so our original objective. So what I want you to do is to take the larger lens, put it up here, then take the second one and move them back and forth until you get an image. And you will have made a telescope. Okay. Now what he did was put them in a barrel, make it more easy to adjust, and you've got, but he had to create the lenses himself when he did that. So start one here and another one here. Now I actually maybe someone does anyone know where Venus is in the night sky right now? A real bright object in the west. So Venus is out there, and maybe with that one, if someone wants to run out and look at Venus through, tell me what you see. Would you like to run out there and look and see when you get that? Okay, so I think if you run to the balcony on that side and look, you might be able to see Venus. You can't, but that's fine. But I was curious to see if you could actually see what it looks like through that little telescope. So, 400 years ago, he's come up with a telescope. And again, he didn't invent it, but it's what he did with the telescope. And, of course, the first thing he did was make money on it. How did he make money on it? No. We did that here. Actually, he sold it to the Venetians so that they could see quicker when approaching ships were coming. So it had a military advantage. He started the whole military industrial complex realizing this and making money off of it. So that was good. So a good idea for this. Okay, so what is he going to do with the telescope? A few of the things. First, the moon. He's going to discover craters on the moon. He's going to discover what he thought were seas. We now know that they're not seas, but they're just darker regions from impacts that form larger craters, deeper craters on the moon. He looked at, here it is. Here's Jupiter. So here's what he would see through his telescope. Jupiter. And these dots are going to be the satellites around there, the moons around Jupiter that he began to watch. And originally he named them the Medicean moons for Cosmos de' Medici, who was his benefactor at the time. And later, physicists don't like to name things after royalty or wealthy people, so it became the Galilean moons, these four large moons that are larger than... some of them are as large as Mercury. So he watched them move around. Of course, they're just going to dance around, and over time he could see that it really looked like they're going around Jupiter over there. So that's the view, what he would have seen through his telescope, and there's an idea of his telescope there. He also looked at Venus. That's why I wanted him to look at Venus. And the surprising thing is right now, if you go look at Venus, it's very, very bright in the sky. If you look through a telescope, Venus is going to look like this crescent. Okay. It's a crescent. What else is crescent shaped at times? The moon. And so what Galileo realized, probably, and this is a bit of contention, was that if Venus showed phases like the moon, then that meant Venus is moving around the sun, and we're moving around the sun, and we're seeing it at different places as we both move. So again, it's relative motion, but moving around the sun. We get phases of the moon because the moon moves around us, and it's the relative position of sun and moon that we get to see it. So you've done this. Now, Dr. Maddox mentioned at the beginning, I believe it was something about also not revealing your ideas too much at the time to others, and Galileo definitely demonstrated it, because in 1610, he wrote to a to Kepler, basically, who was in Prague at the time, and he didn't send it directly to Kepler. But he sent a message that was going to Kepler that was encrypted. So he had it in Latin with a cryptogram in Latin. Okay, and it was decided for Kepler. And the message was, the mother of love emulates the figures of Cynthia. So first of all, why did he encrypt it? Why did he encrypt this message? Yes.
Because of the Inquisition. Possibly heresy.
Actually, that's a good idea. That's probably a strong reason, but there's a secondary reason too.
So that the information wouldn't get out there until it's time.
Right? It's a way of copywriting things at that time. It's a way of copywriting. Because he held the cipher to decode.
Where did he say again, mother of love?
Emulates the figures of Cynthia. And we'll come back and realize what it means. Kepler tried to decode it and didn't come up with it. He came up with Jupiter has a red spot that rotates, which is very interesting because it does. But they couldn't see that at that time. So I think Kepler was an alien. But that was just a very, very strange coincidence that that happened. Okay, what did this mean? Mother of love, that is... Did you see Venus?
Yes, sir.
Did you see... Did it look like anything?
Outside, really can see
it just looked like a god again. Yeah, so we need a bigger telescope. I was just telling him, it would have looked like this. Crescent. You could see it well enough. A good enough telescope. Okay, so mother of love, Venus emulates... exhibits the figures of Cynthia. Cynthia is the moon. Diana, Cynthia, all names for the moon. So he's just saying that he wanted to know, did Kepler know that Venus should exhibit phases? Because Kepler was another ardent supporter of the Copernican system. And so he was testing Kepler to see if he knew this. Now, the other thing that came up historically was that Galileo sent this letter off, I think, December 9, 1610, and a former student of his, Bernardo Castelli, sent a letter to him about 10 days earlier, asking him this very question. Had he observed phases of Venus with his telescope? And then Kepler said, so the whole question was the idea Kepler's or his student's? Italians say it is Galileo's. And it probably was because I could actually go back and recreate this now with software, go back and look at what the phase of Venus was at that time, and if it were not in a crescent phase, then he wouldn't have had the chance just to go up and look and check and then send off the letter. And so that would mean he had already noticed it over time. Just then figured, uh-oh, somebody else knows this, I better copyright my ID and let's see if Kepler knows about this. So that's a little bit of historical controversy. But he did that. Okay, do you have a question? Yes. That was Tycho's idea.
And then same with Jupiter. Even though it's going to be one on Jupiter,
yeah, so
sun.
That could be, but the thing with Jupiter was the idea at that time was we were the center of the whole universe, so therefore everything had to go around us, not any other object. So that was the difference. That they weren't going around us, they're going around Jupiter. Even if Jupiter were going around us, it wasn't that they were going around us as the central body. Yeah, but that is why would it be bigger if matter naturally, its natural place is to come to the center of the universe, which is us. So it should come around us in orbit if it's in orbit, like our moon does, and like we see the sun do, and we can see Jupiter do. So. That's going to happen because the stuff up there is, well, not made of earth. It's that other material, the quintessence, so it doesn't have to fall to earth as such. So, I mean, you have good arguments. I mean, those are good arguments, but I'm pretty sure he would have countered them all the time. So, but now, in terms of Venus, to see the phases, and by the way, as the phase gets smaller, as you see here, it gets bigger too. And that tells us that it's getting bigger because Venus is closer to us and farther from us at times as well. So it's not really moving around us. And Tycho, by the way, did exactly what you said. He wanted to preserve the centrality of the Earth, and then he looked at the Earth, Moon, and then the Sun moving around us, and the other things moving around the Sun. So he tried to do a hybrid system. And the end result is we had it turned to experiments, and it was Kepler, Tycho's observations and then Kepler's mathematics that were to show there was a simpler way of looking at it. So we have to go use Occam's razor and say the simpler theory that can explain it is probably the better. So he made some of these observations, and here's a view of the sun at noon over a course of a year. So he probably never realized the sun would do this. This is it rising and how high up it goes. And it traces out an analemma in the sky, which depends. You can actually figure out your latitude from the size of the analemma that's there. And this would represent the equinoxes, the summer solstice, and the winter solstice as it rises. This is a kind of famous photograph that was there. So Galileo is now going to reconcile some problems with the idea of the Earth moving, and that is that we see stars move daily around us. That's the diurnal motion. And what causes that? Well, that's the Earth rotating. So we see the stars rising in the east because the Earth's rotating the other. So that was kind of an easy one. But if you then make the Earth rotating and not sitting here, first we don't feel it rotating. But if it's rotating, why don't things fly off? Because if you figure out how fast the Earth is rotating, it's rotating over 1,000 miles per hour at the equator. That's pretty fast, 1,000 miles per hour. So why aren't you holding on to your seats here? Now, this is a practical idea. And then the Aristotelians raised other objections that he brings up in Dialogues Concerning Two Chief World Systems, and that is, how could birds ever be seen flying any direction except from here, it's rotating this way, rotating, flying, say, from west to east. But they couldn't go faster than 1,000 miles an hour and overcome that rotation. So how can we see it? Birds do this. Or how is it that you drop something from a tower and it lands at the base of the tower? So Galileo decided to tackle these questions, and in a way then is doing something remarkable, because he's looking at stuff on Earth to reconcile how stuff outside of us moves, how the rest of the then known universe is moving. So he's making a connection between terrestrial effects and cosmic effects, if you want to call it then, heavenly motions. And Newton will do the same thing.
Sleep system, this is not a sleep question, but do they think that the sun, they talk about the sun being further away?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Which one do they think is further?
The sun. The sun. And actually, Aristotle has that in his physics. He has proof of this. And we also know that they're around like shadows and eclipses, and the fact that know the sun is farther because the moon can get between us and there, so that can cause an eclipse. So there's good logic from observation. Aristotle was outstanding observer of nature, especially biology, and a very good consistent system. We had to go to some abstractions for things on Earth, like the vacuum, and then in space we really needed observations. We needed the telescope. Naked eye was not good enough to really decide the species.
What's diurnal?
Diurnal is daily motion when the stars rise and they set in the west. So, you know, if we observe this, which we do, then Copernicus is saying that's caused by rotation. That creates a whole other set of problems on the Earth if we're rotating as fast as we are, so that it's once every 24 hours that happens. So, what we have here. So, what Galileo is doing is combining these two. Terrestrial physics on one side, he looked at the science of motion, two new sciences. He's looking at a combination of observations and abstraction, and then he's looking at relative observers, law of falling bodies, law of inertia. On the other hand, he's looking in the heavenly bodies. Again, he's doing observations. And again, he's called the father of modern science because he introduced the role of observation in science. Before that, remember, it was natural philosophy. And how do you discuss philosophy? Do you do experiments? No. No, you talk about it, you have logic, and that's what's done. So he moved it into a new realm, and that's where he forever stayed. So that's why we give him credit. So his observations, I didn't have Venus on there as well, kind of put these together. I thought there was another dimension to that, but this is how he's going to wed these two ideas together.
Can I say science and motion reconcile?
Reconcile observations and motions with a moving Earth. That was the thing, like the tower, dropping something from the tower, using the law of inertia to reconcile. By the way, two new sciences. Does anyone know what the two sciences are? Two chief world systems. What are the two world systems? Let's go to the second question. Two chief world systems. Yeah. And then they were called Ptolemaic and Copernicus. Two people who had advanced them. So those are those. Now, two new sciences. This is kind of interesting because I spent a couple years at Caltech, and when I first went there, I went to see Richard Feynman. You probably never heard of him. He's a Nobel laureate, very famous in physics. And I went to see him, and he was sitting there with his legs propped up on his desk. I was just trembling. And he said, "Oh, you're working on this project. Two new sciences. What are the two sciences?" And I knew one, which is motion, study of motion, kinematics, falling bodies. And I'm like, what's the other? So they said, "Well, you got to go do your homework." So I went and I looked it up, and I gave you one of the readings in there just because I was embarrassed. And that had a deal with pictures of the bones, like this. And it's a forgotten science. Literally, but it's actually used a lot that you don't hear about it as a science. It's something called scaling. And the idea would be very simple. Could we take and just take you into a three-dimensional Xerox machine and make you 20 feet tall? Wasn't there a movie like that with the actress? And Daryl Hannah. So could we do that? Why not? You would collapse. Your bones aren't strong enough to support that weight. But do we have creatures that were really big? Dinosaurs? And what's the difference between our bones and dinosaur bones? They're huge. They have to be reinforced. So here's kind of a combination. If you had to increase the size, the bone would have to get much, much bigger in cross sections to support your weight. And that's what he started to explore. He said, you couldn't just do this. And so, why do things happen like that? Like, why is it that the largest mammal is the blue whale? Why is it an elephant or something? You have to support the weight from water. Water helps support it so they can still exist like that. Or why is it that shrews have to eat constantly when they're awake? Why do shrews have to eat constantly? They become cannibalistic. They're so small, and what it is they have lots of surface area, little volume, so they lose heat rapidly. So to keep their biological process going, homeostasis, they have to keep providing energy. I like to think of the following. You take a tortilla. Warm up a tortilla, you take it out, what happens to it right away? It's cold. You warm up a baked potato, you take it out, and ouch! It's still hot. Why? Yeah, but the potato has more of a volume to hold the heat, and the tortilla has a big surface. So the surface to volume ratio is very big for the tortilla, and smaller for the potato. So he was the one who first investigated this. And that's the second science in tuning science.
What did you say that science is called?
Scaling. Kinematics, the law of motion, laws of motion, study of motion. So those would be it. And most of the book is on the study of motion, the study of scaling, which is smaller. And by the way, scaling became very important in the 1960s and 70s in an area called energy physics. You may have heard of the Large Hadron Collider in CERN in Switzerland that started up last semester. Well, that uses scaling laws to describe, very, very large scaling laws to describe the physics of things. So it's kind of started here. Okay. So let's go on. Oh, yeah. Get to the end of Galileo here. So, we know that near the end of his life, he is going to publish two new sciences, I think 10 years before he died, and he died under house arrest. I find interesting is that his tomb is in the Church of San Croce. Have you heard of that before?
Is it about Catholic?
What?
He's still devout Catholic?
Yes, yes, he was. He was a Catholic all his life, and devout, yes. No, okay. He had the disagreement over the models of the universe. But in the tomb, there's everything except one finger. And that one finger is shown here, and it's at the Museum of the History of Science in Florence. So this is a big attraction to go find out what finger, see his finger, there it is, who knows how it got separated. And then there's an inscription on this marble pedestal that's holding it, and it says something. And if you go to the Museum of Science in Florence, you can see this and read it. It's something like, this is the finger that first pointed out the heavenly motions, and this you know, it's greater than Titian and stuff like this. It's a lot of praise for him. That's it. His finger. What?
Some fingers.
Yeah. So, it's sort of an interesting. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the second person who's going to pick up Galileo. In fact, he is born, we changed calendars, but basically we say he was born within the year of Galileo's death. So it's like the gauntlet had been passed to Sir Isaac Newton. Newton's going to follow in this because he's still going to call it natural philosophy. He's going to put more mathematics in the description, much, much more than Galileo had. And he's also going to create a framework to look at all of motion in the entire universe. So a few things. 1642, Galileo dies, and Newton is born Christmas Day, 1642. But as I said, we changed calendars, so really it was 1643. 3. Close. Here's his family's farm at Woolsthorpe. Most of these are kind of uninteresting dates. If you want to read a good book on Newton, I think the best is Never at Rest by Richard Westphal. Never at Rest. Unfortunately, it's not a book. But it's pretty good insights into character Newton. There was another one that came out a few years ago by James Gleick, who did a book on chaos called Newton. It's kind of boring compared to the other one. It was kind of interesting. What are a few other things that are interesting? Well, one thing is to know that he held the Lucasian chair at Cambridge. And does anyone know who holds that chair now? Stephen Hawking, yes, Stephen Hawking holds that chair now. So this one he held. Interesting developments. 1665, the plague hit Cambridge, so school was dismissed. And being an industrious person, Newton didn't want to waste time when he went back to his family's farm. So he gave himself a set of tasks to do over that year. And during that year, he ended up discovering the universal law of gravitation, inventing calculus, and starting a framework for his book on the principle of the laws of motion. Okay. So I always tell my students when spring break comes up, I hope you have a list of things to accomplish over it. Remind him what Newton. In a similar period later, he's going to do something here, but this is the plague. I guess it was 2 years of the plague over at that time. Other dates. So talking about just the character of Newton, does anyone know what he was like? Friendly, jovial, personable, cold? Introverted, cold, would work, neglect eating. What else? Kept his ideas to himself. Another characteristic. It's just into his work. Did you know he wrote more about theology than he did physics? He wrote probably as much in alchemy. Searched other things and did it. So one of the other interesting things is that his time to be appointed a professor, you had to be a clergyman in the Church of England. And he was in Trinity College of Cambridge. So he would have to become an Anglican priest. And he didn't believe in the Trinity. So he had a great, he ended up getting a dispensation. He had several disputes over originality of ideas. Claims of plagiarism were made against him. One you probably heard about from high school or college, and that was with Leibniz. What was Leibniz known as? The co-inventor of
calculus.
Calculus, yes. So there was a dispute over calculus from the continent to England. That was a dispute, but not a major one. The biggest one was with Hooke. Hooke's also British. Hooke was a member, and I think he was actually chair of the Royal Society of London, a very esteemed physicist or scientist, probably a physicist at that time. And Hooke claimed that Newton stole his optical ideas, but also that he stole his idea on gravity, his universal law of gravity. Hooke had a law of gravity. It wasn't right. Newton didn't. Newton really, I think, disliked Hooke. And there's a very famous quote by Newton: "If I have seen farther, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. And what he meant was that he used the work of Galileo before him. He didn't use the work of Hooke. And he wanted to show you that Hooke was not a mental giant. In fact, he wanted to show that Hooke was a mental dwarf, because Hooke was actually a dwarf. So it was a very personal attack on Hooke by saying that. So this is kind of Newt. I mean, he's not someone you'd go out to lunch with, sit down and chat with. You don't want to get on his bad side. Kind of a character. Now, one other interesting thing, I guess he did have a friend in Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet fame. And in 1684, in a conversation, Newt supposedly mentioned that, well, comets, like planets, would follow paths around the sun that are conic sections. Do you know what conic sections are? What are they? Circles, ellipses, parabolas, hyperbolas. And Newton knew that these are the shapes of orbits. That's the only shape of orbits you can have. And so Halley said, well, where did you find this? He said, well, I invented this, but I don't remember. So Halley urged him to write this and to write it up, and that then became his way of getting into writing his own secret, which was way beyond that as well. But again, it was, you know, he had these ideas, he had done some proofs, never saw them. So finally, in 1687, he published the Principia, which is Philosophia Naturalis Principia Mathematica. So the philosophical principles of math, the mathematical principles of natural philosophy. He suffered two nervous breakdowns during lifetime, and basically was elected a member of the Royal Society, was knighted, served in the House of Lords. The only thing he's ever quoted as saying was, when someone opened the window one time, he never spoke up in the House of Lords, and then he died in 1727. So a lot going on there. And so here are the shoulders of giants, we said, the two. I find these two paintings interesting. Do you find them interesting? Yeah, they're kind of looking at each other. That's, I guess I put them that way. But each one in its own. What? Don't you get the idea that like someone's watching over their shoulder? Fearful? Yes. Paranoid. And of course, Copernicus, which goes before this era, published his work on his deathbed because he didn't want to get into trouble with the Catholic Church. So he waited till his deathbed, and then there's a controversy over who wrote the preface to the book, because it seemed like it wasn't his. Galileo's looking over there here. Now, the time at which this painting was made, I actually looked it up, and Galileo was blind at that time. So that may be why his eyes kind of have that look, but it does look, to me it looks tired, it looks someone who's wary of what's going on. That's him. Okay. So, now let's look at Newton's ideas, first a little philosophically, and then more in detail, what he's going to bring to the Baroque world. First, he's going to create what we call a mechanistic universe. And you probably have heard that he kind of views the universe as a clockwork. The divine creator wound up the clock, and then everything's moving, playing out according to this. And we're talking not about people, we're talking about physical objects moving in the universe. And so to really describe this, which he's going to do in his Principia, he has basically some underlying framework for this mechanistic universe. And first he's going to say that we're going to have a complete description that when we figure out the forces, which then we incorporate as laws of nature, that that's all. We don't have to pull in some unknown outside influence or something like this. But it's self-contained, complete, is what it would be. Most important that it's deterministic, that with knowing the laws and knowing the motion of something at one time, we can predict the future behavior. And this is one idea that really, really gained hold in science, gave science its strength. Yes, and then it became a weakness when it was tried to apply to other areas. You have things like social Darwinism, other crazy ideas that came out that
Mendelian history.
Yeah, they don't follow the system. This is for physical objects, yes, deterministic. But then again, in the 20th century, about 1980s, we found another thing in physics where it's not deterministic. We don't know what was discovered then. Chaos theory, yeah. So there's the whole thing of chaos and what's that, but that's something else. Getting back to him, the universe, we can predict the future with certainty. And those predictions are unique. That there's only one outcome for one given set of circumstances. So we have uniqueness coming in there. And if we were to do experiments over and over with the same conditions, we would find the same conclusion. So we have a consistency. We don't depend on the whims of gods anymore, or goddesses, to construct things. Nature is going to be very consistent.
How does that apply to people? Where is it supposed to?
It's not supposed to. But okay. People try to apply it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but how do you keep saying this plan to the world first?
Ah, because he's only interested in the physical.
Yeah,
physical, but there's the mental part. So, at that time, we don't understand the connection between physiology and all the processes. We still don't understand the connections. So, yes, the physical, but there's free will. There's all these things, soul that goes beyond the physical into a pain. So Newton definitely shies away from anything. And then lastly, it's based on a separate reality that when we do an experiment in physics, like rolling balls on inclined planes, we don't change or disturb that world at all. The whole world doesn't change. And this is one that in the 20th century gets changed when we get to quantum theory. The quantum theory is interaction, and this doesn't really hold anymore. So, but back in the 1600s, this is going to be what happens there. So, as I said, in the Principia is where we're going to find this laid out in an axiomatic system. And he's going to say in there in the preface that from these principles, I now demonstrate the frame of the system of the world. Describe how all physical things work. And philosophers have attempted the search of nature in vain, but I hope the principles here laid down will afford some light either to this or some truer method of philosophy. So he's looking again, that word of physics coming up for the true nature of how things behave on the earth and in the heavens. So, he has some principles. These are kind of highlights from your readings. So we are to admit no more causes of natural things than such as are both true and sufficient to explain their appearances. So we go to a minimalist approach. That's, we look for Occam's razor. We look for the simplest way, the most compact, efficient way to explain what's going on there. Second overarching rule. To the same natural effects, we have to assign the same causes. The same effects have to produce the same causes. So, if we observe the moon going around the Earth, and moon's going around Jupiter, then what can you conclude? The same cause, the same thing, what's that thing you need? around us. Gravity. So he's going to say, okay, I'm just saying the same cause would be gravity. And we'll look at that in a little bit. Okay, the third rule. Let's see, the qualities of bodies are to be esteemed the universal qualities of all bodies whatsoever. Okay, this one looks a little complicated. So what does he mean here? Well, if we look at a body, what can a body have? It can have a mass. So all objects would have mass. For example, universal qualities of all bodies whatsoever. Bodies can be moving. They can have a velocity. So anything can have a velocity, depends on the situation. So we're going to basically say that we can have the same traits, the same characteristics of all the types of bodies that we experiment with. Okay, and I think now we get to an important one in Rule 4. In this experimental philosophy, we're going to look upon proposition collected by general induction from phenomena as accurately or very nearly true, notwithstanding any contrary hypothesis that may be imagined, till such time as other phenomena occurs by which they may be either made more accurate or liable to exception. So what does he mean here? Saying here is we may do experiments, we make some general, say, laws that come about them. Those laws we believe are going to be true until we find a contradiction. And if we find a contradiction, we can either refine the law, there may be an exception, or we're going to have to replace the law. Fundamental idea in science now, that we make, I like to say models. And those models aren't absolutes. They can be replaced over time as we get better data. For example, we're going to see his law of gravitation. That law of gravitation in the 1900s was supplanted by Einstein's law of gravitation. It couldn't explain everything. So usually it's that a law or a model fails to describe some new phenomenon. And you either amend the law or you replace the law. And fundamental operating principle in science. Okay. So what are his laws? Three laws of motion. This is where physics students have to know one, two, three. It's one, what's two, what's three. First law, the law of inertia. What's that state? Objects stay in motion in a straight line with constant speed unless something interrupts them, something accidental. So that's just what Galileo did. So he took Galileo's law. Second law says, okay, well, not everything moves in a straight line with a constant speed. So something has to change its motion, and that something is called force. And forces are the agents of change. And how do they change? They change according to the fact that the net force acting on a system is equal to the mass of the system times the acceleration. So in other words, forces create acceleration. For a given force, the smaller the mass, the greater the acceleration. Does that make sense? Smaller mass, greater acceleration. It's easy to get it to move. And the larger the mass, the smaller the acceleration. So if I write it as a symbol, the acceleration is force over mass. So for a given force, a given push on something, the greater the mass, the smaller the acceleration. Is it, which is easier to get moving? A ping pong ball or a Mack truck? Because it has smaller mass. That's what he, so he's relating the two, where the cause is force, the result is acceleration. So acceleration is caused by this thing, force, and now we have to explore what our force is. So he needed, he needed a third law to come to this, and that we know as a law of action-reaction. So let me do an example first, and then we'll go from there. So I have my palm here. What I want you to do is touch my palm without my palm touching you. Just do it. Touch my palm without my palm touching you. Can you do it? No. You can't touch without being touched. Newton realized that laws are between things all the time. They're between things. So I push on the table. What does the table do to me? Pushes back on me. I'm pushing against the wall. When I lean in it, the wall is pushing back on me. Now for a tough one. The earth is pulling down on me. Right? Gravity? Pulling down on me. So what's the reaction force? The earth is pulling down on me.
Spinning.
Yeah. Okay, let's do this again. I push on the wall. Wall pushes on me. So interchange the subject and object. I push on wall. Wall pushes on me. Earth pull on me. I pull on the earth. You do?
I was trying to do your lift.
Yeah, that's right. But it's I pull on the earth. So why doesn't the earth move?
Because it has greater mass.
It's very good. It has greater mass. Exactly. It's right here. It's right here. So the acceleration is going to be the same force, but if we put, we're looking at the acceleration of the earth has a big mass, so it doesn't accelerate much more. I, on the other hand, if I'm in free fall, have a much smaller mass, I have a bigger acceleration. Okay, now for a test question. You're driving along Stemmons Highway, okay, coming to class, and it's more in spring. All of a sudden, a bug splats on your windshield. You get this nice green little mark on your windshield. Did you know there's a website you can go to and identify the bugs by the splats on your windshield? So, which experiences the greater force? Your windshield or the bug?
The same.
Between them, the bug pushes on the windshield, the
bug.
Now we've got dramatically different results. Why? So what does the bug experience a greater of?
Not flying.
Yes? The greater
force.
No, we said the force is acceleration. Because the bug has a small mass, greater acceleration. By the way, do you know what kills people in accidents?
Acceleration.
Yes, because what happens is, if you don't have a seatbelt or something like that, you smash into something, but your internal organs have inertia. They keep moving. And they can get ripped out. You break the blood vessels. That's internal bleeding.
Is that why people who like fall asleep or relax or whatever? I mean, I was. Is that why they don't die? Because their body just goes with it.
Yes. Okay. So there's three laws that he sets forth in the Principia that we need. So this one says, okay, we don't have forces. That's a natural motion. If we do, we have the agent of change produces acceleration. And then how do forces behave? They're always between things. And you did well on the quiz for that. So, now we have to identify what are all the forces in nature. Give me some forces that you know about.
Wind.
Okay, wind, what else? Water.
Heat.
What other forces?
Gravity.
Oh, another one.
Water.
Water, you said water. What's making this? Lights light up.
Projection.
Electricity.
Electricity. Things, you could say anything. Can you say anything? It would be a force now, like a car or anything?
Cars can exert forces.
Okay, they can exert a force.
So they can exert a force. So that was the search, then, was by generations of physicists to find all the forces of nature and to identify them and to look at the consequences according to him. So we did this other thing where we went for Galileo, the universe had terrestrial and heavenly. In Newton's, he's going to have the terrestrial part is coming from his Principia, the idea of forces and his law of motion. In the heavenly part, there's the discovery of the universal law of gravitation. Now, let's take a little look at how that came about. Of relativity of time. Of course, she's got to go through.
Funding for this program is provided by
Has anyone ever seen this on PBS?
To advance excellent teaching.
It's kind of old now. It's on PBS. 52 half hour programs.
Newton's argument was to imagine someone casting a projectile horizontally, firing a cannon, for example, from somewhere high above the Earth's surface. From Galileo's discovery, Newton already knew that a body dropped from 16 feet above the Earth's surface reaches the ground in 1 second. The distance a cannonball travels depends on its velocity.
So if
the projectile leaves the barrel,
goes farther, but then the Earth does
it travels 30 feet before it hits the ground. 1 second later.
Does it keep firing it faster and faster? It goes farther, but the Earth starts to curve.
That if the projectile were fired fast enough, it would take more than 1 second to reach the ground. The Earth would curve away before the cannonball reached it. In fact, he could imagine a cannonball moving so fast it would never strike the ground. It would just keep falling forever, while the Earth forever curved away beneath it.
What would we say?
In other words, it would be in orbit.
So that's how the moon can be orbiting us. It's moving faster. And it's actually falling.
Zero G, or weightlessness, isn't really the absence of gravity. Astronauts orbit the moon, held there by gravity, just as surely as gravity holds the moon in orbit.
So the International Space Station,
or pulls an apple to Earth.
It's falling.
The objects floating around
fast,
in the atmosphere
are in free fall,
just as the spacecraft itself is. Together, they will continue to fall in their orbit around the moon, just like Newton's cannonball in orbit around the Earth. Isaac Newton knew that the moon, just like a cannonball, keeps falling through eternity, never reaching the Earth. The moon falls through the Earth with an acceleration of g times the mass of the Earth.
This is what he predicted for the acceleration.
Divided by the square of the distance to the center of the Earth.
And he said if it's the same law that consistently that an apple...
The formula is the same as the one for the apple.
Would
or
fall
any other body on Earth.
With this, except it's
except
closer to the center of the Earth.
Distance is
a greater acceleration.
In this case, it's the much larger distance from the Earth to the Moon.
So if you took
the rate
ratio,
at which the Moon falls is smaller than the rate at which the apple falls. It's equal to the radius of the Earth divided by the distance to the Moon squared. That ratio has been known since antiquity. Greek mathematicians calculated the distance to the Moon as 60 times the radius of the Earth. The moon should fall more slowly than the apple by a factor of 60 squared, or 3,600. Since an apple falls 16 feet in 1 second, Newton concluded that each second the moon should fall a distance of 16 feet divided by 3,600. That distance is 1/20th of an inch. That was the prediction made by Isaac Newton's theory of gravity.
Okay, so if gravity behaves like he thought, this universal, meaning it depends on the masses of the two objects between them, and inversely with the distance squared, I don't mean the formula, but if this holds, he made a prediction that an apple falls 32 feet per second, or 16 feet in 1 second, and the moon falls 1/20th of an inch. So he made this prediction, and then he figured out how far does the moon actually fall. Well, we know how far it is, 60 times product. We know how long it takes the moon to go once around. What is it?
30 days.
30 days. So he figured that, so he could figure out its speed, and he said, okay, the moon, if it were to move, inertially should go in a straight line, but it follows a curve, a circle. So then he figured out in 1 second it would go this far, and then here's the amount it fell to actually be on the circle. And so by using just the observations of the distance to the moon, the time of the period of the moon, he was able to predict that that was, calculate that it actually falls 1/20th. So it showed his theory was right. He was able to go from a mathematical abstract description to match it up with observations. And that, when he did that, we have totally the merge of the completion of the physics of the Earth and the physics of heavenly bodies coming to one common description. Okay. Now, he was asked, how does gravity work? And he had this famous line here of hypotheses non fingo. I frame no hypotheses, as he said. For whatever this can be, he wasn't going to go out and say what it is that gravity really is. How does it reach out to the moon, which is so far away, and cause the moon to move around us, to fall towards us? And he said that doesn't have any place in what he's doing. And it was going to be contention, because people said he was bringing the occult, this action at a distance. Descartes thought it was gravity was acting like a hurricane, and that's what caused the moon to move around. It was things pushing against each other, pushing it like this. And Newton said, no, it's just acting at a distance. And it wasn't until Newton that we're able to find out that it's really the curvature of space-time. Totally different idea. So here's his universal law of gravitation, that the force between two objects goes as the product of their masses, M&M. Big G is a constant everywhere in the universe, just a constant. And R, the distance, it falls off as the square of the distance. So it's this action at a distance, a new type of force that has this characteristic behavior. Once he had that force, he could predict the motions of comets, planets, and everything to be those hyperbolic, those conic sections that I mentioned earlier. So that became a consequence when he applied it to things moving in the heavens. One other thing was that in the discovery of Neptune, Neptune was predicted to exist because the orbit of Uranus wasn't a nice ellipse. It had a bump on it. And so using Newton's gravitation, physicists were able to predict where there should be another planet disturbing it. They looked, and lo and behold, they discovered Neptune. So we have another indication of this, and it kept on going. Now, I mentioned earlier, if you try to apply Newton's laws to outside the realm of just physical motion, you get into trouble, and we began to see that in Laplace, who was sort of contemporary, well, came a little after him. He wrote in his Celestial Mechanics that an intelligent being, if one instant knew all the forces and all the positions of things and how they're moving, then that being would know the future and would have known the past. There would have been no secrets. That you can, remember, it's deterministic. So you can predict the future and you would have known the past to it as well. And indeed, that would be true, except for some things in chaos that are there, and that would be a lot to know for the whole universe, so we couldn't do that. Okay. Brought, I think, more unity to the world than it started with when we began Galileo and what was going on. So we get a nice synthesis and a mathematical one at that point. And by the way, one last thing I should say, it was also Galileo who first introduced again the idea of mathematics describing nature, the square law we saw, and Newton brought that even further along. Nowadays, I don't know if you ever walk into a physics classroom, it's all equations on the board. But that's what we use to describe nature so well as mathematics. And that is also a legacy of the universe. 1 minute over. Any questions? Okay, now I know we didn't ask, there are two questions.